This week on Making Contact.
There's a graveyard outside the walls that folks call Red Onion. A man buried there listens to the moans that erupt, wrestles with dust to be the last to see the slanted eyes of Abdullah alone in a cell.
Locked up for months, years, or decades, poetry is a form of self-expression that's become vital to the incarcerated. In prison, poetry can keep you sane and help you move towards a better future.
And I find that with prisoners, when they start beginning to articulate this and are writing it in some kind of way, they begin to realize, hey, wait a minute, everything I've been through has meaning.
This week, a special production by the Prison Poetry Workshop takes us from California's San Quentin prison to a group of Alabama prison poets. And we'll meet a legendary prison poet of the 1960s who helped spark a literary movement. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact.
This is the Prison Poetry Workshop. I'm Ren Smith. Visiting San Quentin Prison in California recently, we ran into prisoner Andrew Ghezzini, who wrote a button-pushing essay about how the state's economic turmoil, not compassion, will lead to his release. It's jarring to hear.
I now clearly see that love had nothing to do with any of this. It was, is, and always has been anger, hate, and vengeance. The president did not save us. The governor did not save us. Nobody in this world did anything to save us. Nor did any of you do anything to save us. In reality, your plan was to keep us here forever. Was it not?
Andrew says the courage to write such a controversial piece and read it in front of the public and corrections officers actually came from a recent visitor to San Quentin.
You know, we were visited one time by an author. His name was Luis Rodriguez. One of the things he said was, write until it scares you. And that stuck to me because I think of a lot of things. And some of the things I think of, I'm afraid to write. Because after all, look where I'm at. I'm in prison. I have to be careful.
And more often than not, writing is kept hidden in prisons, not out in the open. Sit in any prison classroom or recreation room and ask yourself, how many writers are in the room? How many people are writing rhymes or poems? Carefully folded pieces of paper come out of pockets. Words written in tightly stylized handwriting.
Taped to the wall of my cell are 47 pictures, 47 black faces. My father, mother, grandmothers, one dead, grandfathers, both dead, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, first and second, nieces and nephews.
That's poet Etheridge Knight. In 1960, Knight was convicted of armed robbery and sentenced to 10 to 25 years in prison, of which he served 8. He became a poet behind bars and explored isolation, abuse, and racism, among other themes. You just heard a bit of one of his most famous poems, The Idea of Ancestry. In it, Knight gives us a sense of what it's like to stare at the photos of relatives waiting for you on the outside.
It was a place that I know that I would never want to be in. Dreary looking. Even on a sunny day, it was dreary looking.
Knight's little sister, Janice, would make the journey from Indianapolis to Michigan City, Indiana, to see her big brother, and doesn't remember prison life hardening him or making him cynical.
Well, I had got grown by that time, and so I was had went out a lot of times to visit him in Michigan City and everything. And he always seemed happy. I mean, you know, I don't remember ever seeing him down. But then, too, I'm his little sister. So as a big brother, I guess he's always going to seem happy to me. And he was.
As a young black woman growing up in the 1960s, it was refreshing to have an older brother who could help put a changing world in perspective.
Even though he was in prison, he done a lot of uplift to me, you know. And I think he understood a lot of things. I could write him to tell him what was going on with my life, and he would write me back and tell me different opinions of about things.
Knight was in prison during those years that Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and the Black Panther Party emerged as political forces
and cultural icons. He had grown up with Black history and the all-Black schools of the South. He was influenced by the folk stories that rooted him in the voices of his tradition, and he was arguably in prison for so many years because of race. Black men across America who were writing and speaking out couldn't ignore what was going on. Poet James Depp was friends with Knight before and after his incarceration.
You know, everybody, especially Black people, I mean, with, like you said, since we were under siege with all the racism and that we had to speak out against it in our art. You know, and that was the only legal way we could do it. And then people would listen and reevaluate the way that they viewed life.
But Knight may have never fully embodied radical Black nationalism. The poet was too open-hearted, too willing to make a human connection to cut anyone off because of ideology. Here he is in a 1989 interview.
In the joint I was in, there were some guys who had been in there a long time, and they'd lost contact with, they never received any mail or any visits. And there was this group of women, matrons, suburbanites, like, who would come and visit with these men. We call them do-gooders. And this particular day, a guy came to my job and said, "Hey, Knight, you got a visit." And I went and put on my press jeans and ran up and looked out in the visiting room. I didn't see a Black face out there. So I said, "I ain't got no visit." You know, so we started to bicker.
His visitor, it turned out, was one of these do-gooders. And Knight penned a poem about what happened next.
A WASP woman visits a Black junkie in prison. After explanations and regulations, he walked warily in. Black hair covered his chin, subscribing to villainous ideal. "This cannot be real," he thought. "This is a classical mistake. This is a cake baked with embarrassing icing. Somebody's got, likely as not, a big fat tongue in cheek. What have I to do with the prim blue and proper-blooded lady? Christ indeed has risen when a junkie in prison visits with a WASP woman." "Hold your stupid face, man. Learn a little grace, man. Drop a notch the sacred shield. She might have good reason, like, 'I was in prison and ye visited me not,' or some such. So sweep clear anachronistic fear, fight the fog, and use no hot words." After the seating and the greeting, they fished for a denominator, common or uncommon, and could only summon up the fact that both were human. "Be at ease, man. Try to please, man. The lady is as lost as you. You got children, ma'am," he said aloud. The thrust broke the dam, and their lines wiggled in the water. She offered no pills to cure his many ills, no compact sermons, but small and funny talk. "My baby began to walk, simply cannot keep his room clean. Her chatter sparked no resurrection, and truly, no shackles were shaken. But after she had taken her leave, he walked softly, and for hours used no hot words."
Knight had fought hard to arrive as a poet, but may not have been successful without a little help.
You know, it was like 3 years, nothing but rejects. And finally, I had a poem accepted by the Negro Digest. It was a sister magazine to Ebony. I'd been sending poems for months to Hart Fuller, was the editor, and he told Gwendolyn Brooks about me. I suppose he said, "Hey, here's this guy over in the prison in Indiana, keeps sending me all these poems." Yeah, and she wrote to him and asked me to see some of my poems. Then Dudley Randall, who's a publisher of Broadside Press, was one of the most energetic Black presses during the 60s, published my first book. Poems from prisons, mainly poems about my world.
The poetry of Pulitzer Prize winner Gwendolyn Brooks had been widely published for decades before she started writing to talented upstart Etheridge Knight. She was excited by his potential. Here, at the Penn Center in 1986, Brooks tells of receiving a submission from Knight called The Sun Came Out.
Long ago, I wrote a little poem called Truth, identifying truth as sunshine, the opening two lines of which were, "And if sun comes, how shall we greet him?" Well, Etheridge replied to that. "The sun came, Miss Brooks, after all the night years."
Gwendolyn Brooks began to visit Knight in prison. She critiqued his poems, gave him feedback, and helped develop his voice. Another pivotal moment came when Knight answered a certain call for submissions issued by a small but whip-smart publishing house called Broadside Press.
Etheridge Knight sought Dudley Randall out.
That's Melba Boyd. She worked at Broadside Press alongside the now late Randall. She said that, like Gwendolyn Brooks, Randall immediately saw how gifted Knight was and did everything he could to help him.
Dudley actually went to the prison in Indiana. I mean, he actually visited him there and he worked with him, workshopped his poems with him at the prison. I mean, you know, that's a lot. You can do it from Michigan in about, you know, it would probably be at least 5 hours, I would think.
The partnership between Knight, Brooks, and Randall produced a full collection of works that transported readers into Knight's cell.
The poems in prison is mainly poems about my world.
Its poetry reflected the values of the Black arts movement, an analysis of deep structural racism, an unapologetic embrace of Black culture, and a reimagining of Black history. Melba Boyd says that after Broadside Press published Knight, something interesting happened. The Broadside office was suddenly inundated with letters and poems from prisoners, showing exactly how deeply Knight's work had resonated.
They were coming from everywhere. They were coming from prisons. This is a very strong consciousness-raising period.
Knight was released from prison in 1968. At just 37, he'd already been a soldier, a prisoner, and an addict. Now, he was a published poet, one who would, within just a few years, receive a coveted Guggenheim Fellowship and a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts. But most importantly, his poetry inspired hundreds of future poets in and out of prison. It spoke to a generation of young Black men who wanted to find a voice and explore their rich African-American roots. Those letters that streamed into Broadside Press in Detroit, they were just the beginning. I'm Ren Smith with the Prison Poetry Workshop. Now we head south to check out a prison poetry workshop that's been going for over a decade. We arrive at Staten Correctional Facility in the tiny town of Elmore, Alabama.
Your intensity is rising.
10 men are huddled around a conference table, notepads and pencils in hand, because they're participating in a poetry workshop offered by the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project and facilitated by poet Caius Stevens. Caius runs the program, which works with 9 prisons and offers classes in everything from psychology to art. Most workshops are 14 weeks, but this one is just 2 days. Caius explains to them that since they have a short period of time, they'll analyze and write short poems. The first will be based on the poem Photograph by Lucille Clifton. Guy Carter sits up tall in his chair to read it.
My grandsons, spinning in their joy. Universe, keep them turning, turning. Black burrs against the window of the world, for they are beautiful, and there is trouble coming, round and round and round.
Almost immediately, a lively discussion of the phrase, black blurs against the window of the world, erupts. Guy Carter pipes in.
Your children playing. That's where the blackbirds are against the wonder of the world, for they are beautiful. Watch children play. It's marvelous. They're free. And then there's trouble coming round and round and round, because he's going to grow up. And she realizes this.
A slender man in his 40s named AJ offers a more apocalyptic interpretation.
When it said the blackbirds against the wonder of the world, the wonder of the world is this right here, destruction, man is destroying the earth.
But Caius interprets the whole thing differently, in a way that the three men who offered opinions on the image so far, who happened to be white, hadn't considered.
Black blurs suggest the idea that the kids are black. What about this next word? And this is the thing that I think potentially suggests a lot. Against.
You can tell the men are really considering her words.
Let's think about this. This is the power of one word and how one word can potentially change an entire meaning for a poem. If it said black blurs with the window, that's a different meaning.
Yeah.
What does against suggest?
Conflict.
Conflict?
This is the thing about poetry. Separation. It can change before your eyes, right? Even as the text remains fixed.
How do you make
in that way,
happen?
It's the perfect metaphor for prison, where what might seem anchored is often fluid. We'll get back to that in a moment. For now,
come back to this.
An older man, everyone calls Sarge, pipes up.
You know, I came up in the 50s, living in Birmingham, Alabama. You know, when I was growing up, we were carefree and we enjoyed everything, but there were certain things that we could and could not do. We were ostracized from other parts of the city, the town, and the nation.
If you didn't catch that, Sarge is referencing the dark history of segregation. The poem's themes now seem more complex, mixing joy with sadness, contentment with terror. Caius notes how this is accomplished in just 27 words.
That's an amazing piece of writing. It's extraordinary. But you can also, if you are very wise and conscientious with how you use your words, make a very powerful piece in a very small amount of space.
Being able to deliver a powerful idea compactly has particular appeal in a world where prisoners have little control over their schedule. Time, for obvious reasons, is a pertinent subject here. The youngest of the group by a decade speaks up. Though he's only 26, he's been in prison 11 years. He says there's very little quiet time in prison, making it hard to focus on his poetry. So he has to stay up.
Because trying to do it in the daytime is just impossible. Everybody running around, running past you, bumping the rack, slamming this and doing that, drives you insane.
Calvin is just stymied by the focus the older prisoner poets have.
Y'all just incredible to me because to find time to do anything, it takes a lot of dedication, a lot of hard work. Finding time is impossible to me.
The workshop, at least, provides a time and place where shakedowns and fire drills, bumping and slamming, aren't issues, allowing the men to work on their craft and relative peace. Caius gives an assignment.
With your handy-dandy pen, I want you to write a list of nouns, right? 20 nouns. Book, cup, jar, pen. And then in your next column, when you get done with that, verbs. Don't feel like you have to think about this really hard. Just go with what comes.
The men connect words from one column to the other at random. They circle three pairs and then write a short poem about them. Going around the room, it's time to share. Soon, it's Calvin's turn. His poem utilizes the words ocean and touch. And though he's one of the younger participants, he uses minimalist language reminiscent of Robert Frost or Langston Hughes.
As I sit down on the pier with my feet swinging in the air, I could feel the ocean's touch between my toes, and Lord knows I just want to thank him so why I don't even really know.
Though Calvin read that quickly, there's an aching and lyrical ponderousness to the poem, one that calls to mind his yearning for a little peace and quiet. as I sit down on the pier with my feet swinging in the air, I can feel the ocean's touch between my toes. And Lord knows, I just want to thank him so. Why? I don't even really know. Coming up, we'll hear from one poet sent to prison when he was just 16 and how poetry led him to Yale Law School.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to a special production by the Prison Poetry Workshop.
For our last stop on the Prison Poetry Tour, we want to chat with a guy named Dwayne Betts. He lives up in Connecticut now. He's an award-winning poet and a student at Yale Law School. But he grew up in the D.C. metro area and was sentenced to 9 years in adult prison at 16 back in the late 1990s. His crime was carjacking, and it could have been worse. While he got 9 years, he could have faced life in prison for carjacking.
When I think about my story, the thing I think about most in sort of the early stages is that the longest I've been away from home was 7 days, and suddenly, you know, I'm facing life in prison. So I plead guilty to carjacking, and I get sentenced to 9 years, and started Southampton Correctional Center.
It's a familiar story. A young black man raised by a single mother ends up in prison. Betts never thought it would be his own, and in a way, it wasn't. In court, Betts refused to blame his actions on faulty parenting or to suggest he would have turned out differently had his father been around.
And so I felt like I was intelligent enough and I was smart enough as a kid to know better than to carjack somebody, and I wasn't willing to throw my mom under the bus at that moment, which is wild to me now because I was facing life.
In his book, A Question of Freedom, a memoir of learning, survival, and coming of age in prison, Dwayne looks back on how his whole life changed because of an ill-conceived crime that took 30 minutes. In his book, he brings us with him as a squad car ferries him toward his new jumpsuit-clad life, and the enormity of it all weighs on him. Here's Dwayne.
16 years hadn't even done a good job of my voice. It cracked in my head as I tried to explain away the police car driving my 126 pounds to the Fairfax County Jail. Everything near enough for me to touch gleamed with the color of violence. The black of the deputy's holstered guns, the broken leather of the seat I sat on, and the silver of the cuffs that held my hands before me in prayer. When I closed my eyes, I thought about the way the gun felt in my palm. I tried to remember what caliber pistol was, but couldn't. It was automatic and weighed nothing in my palm, and I couldn't figure how something that weighed nothing could have me slumped in the back of a car driving me away from my life. My wrist almost slipped through cuffs that held me captive as jailhouse danger swirled red in my head.
Betts was kind of an outlaw nerd, a person whose impression of prison life came from books and pop culture.
I want to tell you that I could talk tough, that I was going over everywhere I knew to say back up off me, but I wasn't. That ain't this story. This is about silence and how in an 8-year period I met over a dozen people named Juvenile or Youngin or Shorty, all nicknames to tell the world that they were in prison as young boys, as children. We wore the names like badges of honor because in a way for some of us, it was all we had to guard us against the fear. And we were guilty and I was just like everyone else. I thought about the edge of a knife.
When Dwayne was sentenced, his judge looked at him and said something that still bothers him to this day.
I am under no illusion that sending you to prison will help you, but you could get something out of it if you want.
That still irks Dwayne.
For real, I think that was just the chip that I put on my shoulder and I've carried my entire life. And for two reasons. One, because if it won't help me, how will it help society? You're giving me 9 years. I'm gonna be 25 years old when I come home. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense at all. And yeah, I got something out of it, but the thing is, I took it though.
Though getting something out of his time wasn't something he did on his own.
And one of the ways I survived without trying to be the tough guy is that people enforced the worth in being an intelligent dude. So when I would be sitting down in the block in Sussex, reading a book on the floor, you know, nobody clowned me. You know, when I would be studying Spanish at Augusta, 3-4 hours a day, running around on the soccer field speaking Spanish, like nobody clowned me. You know, when I was working in the law library and I was helping people with their cases, people showed up and clowned me then.
In other words, Betts wasn't aided by prison as much as by prisoners.
Some people got stomped out. Some people got mistreated and all of that. So I'm not trying to deny the existence of that. But what I'm trying to do is say, if this is going out to the world, the thing that people don't think about in prison is the way in which men nurture men and the way in which, yeah, I was raised in prison. And so, if it was like the first person, you know, it's like outside of my mom, like the first real person that believed that I would be where I am in today, it was the men who were around me.
Betts is a family man and writer now, enrolled at Yale Law. But he still carries his experience.
And this is why I think people who have been in prison have to be a part of this conversation about reform, because, you know, it's a particular kind of history that I think I've come to carry with me because I got locked up. And partly because I thought I wouldn't get locked up, and I didn't expect to get locked up. And I thought I was better than the man who went in prison because I thought I wouldn't be in prison. I thought somehow my education shielded me, right? And I'm getting locked up, I found out that I wasn't the most brilliant person, period. You know, I knew some people who were far more intelligent than I was, people who did things like with their mind from inside a cell that I just didn't think was possible.
As someone who's found success, he could be used as an example of the system working. But Dwayne didn't emerge unscathed.
That prison changes you in so many ways, and it can make you brutal, and it can make you hard, and it can scar you. And so you got a system that you know is built like that, and then you had all of these other things around the system that make it even worse, and then you expect somebody to come out whole. And it's just, it ain't even that it's unrealistic. You know, it's immoral, and it's inhumane the way we treat men in prison. And maybe one of the reasons why I emphasize the sort of positive stories that I have and those moments that I have is because, you know, I got to hold on to those to balance out the darkness, because it is some darkness, you know.
To end today's show, we want to bring you one last poem from Dwayne Betts. It's simply called Prison.
The Sinner's Bouquet. House of shredded and torn Dear John letters. Upended grave of names, moon black kiss of a pistol's flat side. Time blueborn and threaded into a curse. Lazarus of hustlers, the picayune spinning in the beatdowns. Breath of a thief stilled by fluorescent lights. A system of 40 blocks, empty vials, a handful of purple crane's bills. Memories of crates suspended from stairs, tied in knots around street lamps. The hours of unending push-ups, wheelbarrows and walking 20s. The daughters chasing their father's shadows, sons that upset the wind with their secrets. The paraphrase of fractured, scarred wings flying through smoke. Each wild hour of lockdown, hunger time, and the blackened flower.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Prison Poetry Workshop for this week's program. You can learn more about them at prisonpoetryworkshop.org. For a CD copy of this show, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's where you can get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.